WGBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. The so-called doomsday cult mother, Lori Vallow Daybell, has been convicted in Boise, Idaho. Here's ABC's Ariel Reshev.
The mom showing no emotion as she was convicted of murdering her own children. She now faces up to life in prison without parole. Prosecutors saying they are pleased with this verdict and they are now focused on Chad Daybell's upcoming trial.
That's her husband. After a Florida judge temporarily blocked the Biden administration from releasing migrants to the U.S. without formal notice to appear in court, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre blaming Republican efforts.
It is a harmful ruling, and the Department of Justice is going to fight it. That's what we're going to see, and we're going to continue to use every tool that we have to make sure that we are dealing with this issue in a humane and orderly way.
Russians and Ukrainians reporting Ukraine has made successful counterattacks around the city of Bakhmut, regaining ground and inflicting heavy casualties. The FDA has approved the first once-a-day hormone-free treatment for menopause-related hot flashes. This is ABC News. Attorneys for the family of a homeless man who died in a chokehold on New York City subway are welcoming an arrest in the case, but say there should have been tougher charges filed by prosecutors.
12 days after he was seen with his arms around Jordan Neely's neck in a deadly chokehold on a New York City subway, Daniel Penny is possibly facing up to 15 years behind bars. Prosecutors say they reviewed the disturbing video showing Penny choking Neely for at least 3 minutes on a subway train on May 1st and say at the point that the defendant releases his arm from Mr. Neely's neck, Mr. Neely appears to be unconscious. Penny was initially questioned and released without charges, setting off days of protests.
ABC's Stephanie Ramos. One of the two escaped inmates from a Philadelphia prison has been captured. He was disguised as a woman wearing full female Muslim garb. Police still searching for the second inmate accused of killing four people. Andy Field, ABC News.
Oh, now wait until you pull up to the stop and go light. But when you do, go ahead and save the Civic Media station to one of your presets. The Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Behrens, and also on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Republican efforts to remove obscene books from Wisconsin schools are moving forward. Two bills began circulating this week. One leaves schools and staff open to prosecution. The other bill bans districts from using library money to buy inappropriate materials. An historic overhaul of Wisconsin's shared revenue system is one step closer to passing the legislature. The Assembly's local government committee passed the bill yesterday. Democrats tried and failed to remove parts of the bill unrelated to state aid.
I'm a person who believes in local control, and I support local governments, and I want to give them the tools to do what they do best.
That's Representative Clinton Anderson. The bill goes to the full assembly next week, but Governor Evers says he'll veto it without big changes. In sports, the Brewers host Kansas City tonight. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now. And AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs.
But it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, could potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Krebscast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, British voters not happy. New report from the BBC. Evidently, they're now coming around over in the UK to this idea of voter ID. Nobody's happy because, you know, people are, they've always voted in the same place. Kind of like it happened here. You know, you've been going to the same polling place for years and years and years. And now you got to bring your ID and now they're turning you away. Well, this is what's happening over across the pond and they're not happy. But hey, the good thing is, we're getting used to it, and Republicans are finding new ways to attack people to keep them from voting because that wasn't enough. It looks like Ohio is going after some college students with their new voter ID, and here to share some thoughts on all the things that going on there. I've asked our good friend David Pepper to come share some thoughts. He's a former Democratic chair, also the author of Laboratories of Autocracy, a wake-up call from behind the lines. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. Good to be back with you.
So, the British voters not thrilled with voter ID, but in Ohio, you've gone kind of like next level ID.
We've always had voter ID, but it was you had a number of things you could show. Students on campuses who had, you know, let's say they were from another state, didn't have to switch to an Ohio driver's license. They could show that they lived on campus and use that. It was fine. We haven't had fraud. We haven't had problems, but they have been going after young voters in this state really since Obama won in 08. They hated that young voters on campuses showed up in big numbers, and they've been trying to do everything they can. They're basically admitting now around the country when you hear them say we should move the voter age back up to 21. Well, this voter ID bill is clearly targeted directly at young voters who especially, again, they're obsessed with the voters who are on campuses here from other states. They just assume they won't get an Ohio ID or Ohio driver's license, and they won't vote here. And so they passed this about, early this year. It took effect a few weeks ago. We're working very hard. I was just on a call with young people about 2 hours ago, trying to make sure that we get the word out. But we think about 800,000 plus Ohio voters who would otherwise be eligible do not have the very narrow forms of ID that they now need to have. And that's disproportionately Black voters, disproportionately young voters. And it's sort of almost a silent suppression. You know, when the voter ID law officially took effect, that entire week, the Secretary of State, who talks about everything under the sun, didn't even mention it. On the website, you wouldn't even known it was there. It was coming. So it's really just, I worry that after a decade of trying to really make it harder for young voters, this is the probably the most effective and cynical tool they've come up with, which is a much stricter, the most strict in the country, I'm told. And of course, student IDs don't count. So Ohio State's ID or whatever other school, that's not good enough because they don't want young people voting.
See, when this first came up I think it was 2011 when it came up here in Pennsylvania. I said, you know, I'm not against, you know, identifying who I am, or because when I registered, I had to show ID and all this. But if you're going to mandate this and you're going to narrowly define which IDs are okay, I think it's the responsibility of the state to ensure that the voters get what they are mandating that the voters have, because a lot of people don't have driver's license. A lot of people, you know, they don't drive. So I've been in the mindset that it should be the state's responsibility, and it should be an easier process to get this. Like, you know, for the next couple of election cycles, if you're going to mandate this, you should be able to have, you know, on site, you know, someone who can help with this so that we're not turning people away. It's hard enough to get people to come to vote, and you're turning people who are away who are there. I got a problem with that.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the driver's licenses. You know, younger people aren't driving nearly as much. I think the number is at about only 40% of, 40% of 18-year-olds don't have a driver's license. I think at 22, it's like 28% don't. That's huge numbers of voters. And it used to be that it was hard enough to get people to register. Now it's register plus a whole bureaucratic process. And if, I went to school outside of Ohio. I wasn't going to change for my Ohio driver's license. They know that. And so, yeah, this is a real effort to go after using. Now, there is an Ohio state ID that doesn't require a driver's license. And that's what we're going to try and help a lot of people get. But the basic requirement that most people, you know, would normally think about is this driver's license. And we just know that both young people, again, seniors, and disproportionately poor, disproportionately Black voters are far less likely to have this ID. And that's why they do. That's why they pick the IDs they pick. This is not that, you know, they don't even hide it anymore. This is a state that the Secretary of State of Ohio, after the election, brags about how fraud free it was. So the old justification that came about years ago that this was combating in-person voter fraud, they don't even pretend anymore that that's the case. And Mike DeWine, when he signed it, basically is acknowledging this isn't really a concern. It's targeted voter suppression.
Yeah. In our state, when they passed voter ID here in Pennsylvania, before our state Supreme Court threw it out, Mike Terzai, the Speaker of the House, you know, gave a speech and was very clear of why they passed voter ID, and that was to get Governor Romney elected. There was that famous little clip of his, because you're right, they're not even hiding it.
Yeah, no, you're right. He was helpful in admitting it, but they basically now, whatever it is, they're really not hiding that this is about power. This is a group of people that is threatened by a diverse coalition that cost them power, and Obama motivated that coalition. They don't want, and that coalition is young voters, voters of color, women, and whatever they can do to pull out pieces of that coalition that if it were fully active would be a majority, they are eager to do.
Yeah, I'd forgotten.
And they don't hide it. I mean, here's an example. I mean, so you have this strict photo ID now to vote in person, but not to vote by mail. When in-person voter fraud is very difficult as a scheme, it'd be easier to do it in other ways, and they don't have it for that. So even that just doesn't make sense. I mean, it really is it's just voter suppression. And they say it's free. Well, tracking down a birth certificate if you don't have one, other documents, isn't free. And we're working hard to make it free for people if they get the right information. But the basic process costs, you know, working people time to go to the BMV or somewhere else, money, et cetera, which if you're working really hard and several jobs in the wrong shift, it's real hard to do all that stuff.
No, it is. But I remember, you know, in the pretrial to the voter ID law here, the pretrial stipulation, the state actually admitted that the law that they passed, and this is brilliant, would have stopped no form of voter fraud at all. There had never been any case that they could identify, either locally, state, or across the country, that this law would have stopped. It was really a brilliant document in that they admitted that it does nothing, but they believe they should have gone forward because they believed it. It's just crazy. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show here with David Pepper, former chairman of the Ohio Democratic Party and also author of Laboratories of Autocracy, A Wake-Up Call from Behind the Lines. But this power grab that you just said a moment ago doesn't stop it at suppressing votes. Now we want to make it even harder to get amendments put forth, anything on the ballots put forth. What happened to democracy?
I mean, they basically admit they are afraid of the majority of Ohio voters. When you have these hyper super gerrymandered legislatures that are generally pushing laws that are deeply unpopular, they are threatened in any state that allows the people to go directly to the ballot, because that is how that state, we saw this in Kansas last year, that is how that state can basically undo the work of a gerrymandered legislature to advance basically a minority viewpoint as law. And so right now, what are they doing in Ohio? There's a group of people gathering signatures quickly to put an amendment on the ballot to enshrine the right to choose on the Ohio Constitution. It has about 58% support in the polls. It's a majority view. And so they're rushing as fast as they can to have a special election in August to lift the threshold to amend our Constitution to 60% so that they get in front of the majority of Ohioans actually protecting choice. This is a group of people that literally only months ago eliminated the ability of having August elections. And now they're trying to bring them back for their constitutional amendment to forever have a 60% threshold. So they're literally rigging the rules to rig the rules against majority rule in the state of Ohio. And by the way, this is also part of a national playbook. They're going to do this in other states. They tried this in Arkansas. They are threatened. This is such a clear symbol of the current MO, which is they are afraid of the majority of Americans having their will reflected in law. So in states where that can happen through constitutional amendments, they are working to kill that vehicle for the people. It's a total power grab by politicians. In this case, we also happen to be the most corrupt state house in the country. So which makes it a somewhat an easy argument. Do you really want to give the most corrupt state house in the country more power at the expense of the people of that state? I hope the answer will very clearly be no.
Yeah, I hope so too. But hey, at least you're not Texas. I mean, Texas is doing some pretty interesting things as well around voter suppression and preemption laws and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, the truth is all these states, it's a national agenda. They're simply vehicles for a national agenda. So if something happens here, it's going to happen elsewhere, vice versa. These ideas are not being cooked up in Columbus by the legislators who put them forward. They're being cooked up in conference rooms and DC think tanks and boardrooms around the country. And they're brought to these states, which are just going to sound over the top, but it's just true. These are state houses essentially hijacked by extremists with almost no connection back to the people of the states anymore because of gerrymandering and tools like this to further remove them from the people. All of a sudden you have to have 60% come together to reflect itself. Well, that's because the current state house is doing things that 60% don't agree with. They want to keep us from being able to have our say. So they're kind of all the same at this point. I mean, one week it's Missouri, the next week it's Tennessee, the next week it's Texas. It's not like each state is doing this on their own. It's a much broader agenda, coordinated and always sharing what they're doing amongst each other. If something works in one place, it works somewhere else, which, by the way, is a major motivator. If you kill something really badly, like this terrible idea here, the hope is we kill it elsewhere too. Because if they waste a bunch of money and time on something that looks like a dead out loser, maybe it won't come to another state. It's not worth the fight for them. No. So if you could defeat something with gusto, you might do everyone else a favor in the process.
So in talking to people, do you get the sense that folks get this, or, because I had asked a couple of my relatives in Ohio if they'd heard about it or if they cared about it, and they hadn't heard about any of it. Is this getting out?
It's building. I was at the rally on Wednesday. We had a really good sort of late organized rally. It did remind me of that old labor fight we had 10 years ago. The people who are there see it. They're gearing for a fight. They enjoyed being up there and speaking truth to power. And my guess is, and the big vote is this coming Wednesday, if they do push this, I think it could get really big. Like, and you've seen these things get big. I think this could get big. One of the things that's helping, and I'm normally not praising some of these folks, but John Kasich came out and said, this is a horrific idea, a stupid idea. It's undemocratic. Former Governor Taft, kind of an old school, you know, established Republican, former Secretary of State, said, terrible idea. Former attorneys general are saying it, Republicans. So this kind of has the makings of even Republicans saying it's bad, that they are getting too arrogant, too extreme in an August election. If that's when they do it, if the majority see that clearly, just like happened in Kansas a year ago, we might be able to overwhelm them because that side gets so upset about it. And it becomes not just a Democrat or Republican thing, but a much broader coalition. The Libertarian Party came out against this earlier this week. I mean, they see this as a problem. There are certain right-wing interest groups who themselves want to go to the Constitution, and they don't like it. And of course, if you care about the minimum wage being raised, you care about a woman's right to choose, all those groups are also appalled by this. So it may end up unifying a whole lot of people that very rarely are on the same page.
So last question I've got for you then, you know, electorally, will this overreach, will they pay a price for it? Or is Ohio so badly gerrymandered and so far lost that it's not going to matter? And they know that.
I think, you know, we had our big labor battle in 11, and it did not translate into wins after that, although it was a thrashing of the attack on collective bargaining. We really, you know, went to town. And the hope would be, you know, especially if this pro-choice amendment gets on the ballot in November, the hope would be if they do this in August, that does build momentum of the sort of the pro-democracy side, the majority who supports a woman's right to choose, then it does build into a successful November. And you know, if I'm Sherrod Brown of the Ohio Democratic Party, I'm getting involved with this in a way that I want to get every single petition circulator. I want to get every single new voter registered. I want to get voter IDs in the hands of the people who vote this time so they have it for next time. So I think the smart play is to use it to build that and not let it just be a one moment thing, but something that's much bigger. Yeah. And one of the things I hope that we can all benefit from in 24, if it is, they have hidden for a long time quite well how extreme they've gotten, how much in the minority they've gotten. And the hope is that whether it's Marjorie Taylor Greene being the leader of the House, whether it's a DeSantis-Trump primary or things like this, that they're starting to really show that they're far out of the mainstream in a way that they aren't good at hiding anymore. And that could actually also set up some contrast as we head into 24.
Let us hope, because this is just outrageous. But David, I appreciate you taking some time, filling us in on what's going on in Ohio. Thanks so much.
Okay, take care.
David Pepper, former chair of the Ohio Democratic Party. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
It's interesting David brought up the 2011, really an uprising of working class voters in Ohio who turned back John Kasich's no rights at work push. And I still remember because we took the show there in the week prior to the election. And, you know, we were out in the street talking to people and the sentiment, you got the feeling that this could have been a mobilizing moment, that this could have been an opportunity for labor to really, because, you know, look, the state of Ohio went, it was like 2/3 of the vote. I mean, it was a serious thrashing. 2/3 of voters came out and said, no, we don't want to be a no rights at work state. We don't want to be a right to work for less state. We want to be a state where if you work hard, you play by the rules, you get ahead, you get to sit down and you get to bargain, want to be a right to bargain state. And overwhelmingly, but interestingly enough, on the other side was the question of the Affordable Care Act. And voters were not happy with what was thrown into that. So, you know, when you look at what the Republicans in Ohio are doing right now to try and make it harder, make the obstacles harder, to get things, you know, done on the amendment level, it's nonpartisan. I mean, David framed it as, you know, it's bipartisan. It's really not, and this isn't a right left thing. It's the reason that Joe Walsh and I have become friendly. It's the reason that, you know, people that I had viewed as extreme in the past, and, you know, look, on issues, we're gonna be completely in different camps. It's the reason that we're on the same page. This is about democracy. This is about the mechanism. It's not partisan in my view. But he's right. Pepper's right in saying, look, if it's happening in Ohio, it's gonna go across the country. Because the moneyed interests have a view of what this country should be. And you've got the original intent people. Antonin Scalia was a huge original intent guy. You know, blacks are 3/5 people. You know, women can't vote. Only white landowning males over 21 can vote. You know, the original intent. There are people who are working, spending big money, billionaires from all over the place spending big money to push us in that direction. Democracy be damned. And the right loves to tell me, and they do it all the time, you know, Rick, we're not a democracy. We're a constitutionally limited democratic republic. And you go, yeah, in a democratic fashion, we vote for our representatives. Our representatives go and do what we collectively want them to do. That's how this thing works. You know, if the majority of the people want a road fixed, that's a priority. Go help us get that done. We elect representatives to help us get the things done that we need to get done. Not the moneyed interest. And this is where I keep coming back to this moment of, I said it earlier, I don't necessarily blame the politicians. I blame us. For being easily divided, easily pitted against each other, easily sliced and diced and you know, narrow interests here and there. The idea that, and this is where I come back to, that everything has to be framed in the right-left world, in the red hat, blue hat world. Instead of, you know, what's in the best interest of working people. And this is where my mind is. Look, there are some people who do not identify with working class principles and working class ideology. I get that. But understand, people who punch a clock, people who go to work every day and collect a paycheck at the end of the week, that's the majority, the vast majority of the people in this country. You would think that we'd have something in common and we'd want politicians to move stuff like that. We used to be that society. Didn't always agree on everything. But on the economic stuff, yeah, we were doing okay. Until the moneyed interest started pushing back and aggressively and brought us the F channel and brought us the end of the fairness doctrine and brought us this kind of indoctrination media. And then we fell into the silo. Question is, how do we move away from that? And how do we take on bad legislation like we're seeing in Ohio or Texas? I keep coming back to life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. We used to believe in that as a country. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. If you miss any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you get your podcasts, you shall find ours. Back after this.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1931. That was the day that became known as the Battle of Harlan or the Battle for Everts. Harlan County, Kentucky was coal country. Miners worked long hours underground and faced dangerous and often deadly working conditions. If they attempted to form a union, they risked not only losing their jobs, but also getting evicted from their company housing. Despite this response, starting in the 1920s, the United Mine Workers of America began to make headway in organizing miners. In Harlan, the miners who dared organize were fired. They and their families were thrown out of their homes. The company brought in hired guns to enforce the evictions and to keep the union out of the mines. Union miners and these gun thugs met on the road outside of the town of Everts. A gun battle broke out. Three company men and one miner were killed. The governor of Kentucky once admitted, quote, "There exists a virtual reign of terror in Harlan County, financed in general by a group of coal mine operators in collusion with certain public officials. The victims of this reign of terror are the coal miners and their families." The Harlan County Mine Wars raged on for the next decade. In all, 13 miners would give their lives trying to bring a union to the Kentucky coal fields. It was one of the bloodiest struggles of the U.S. labor movement. Bloody Harlan earned its nickname.
They say in Harlan County that Harlan is there.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
When public officials get themselves mired in the muck of corruption, they can always count on Senator Ted Cruz to issue a moral judgment. If the offender is a Democrat, he pronounces the corruption inexcusably grotesque. If it's a Republican, he wails that the offender is the victim. For example, Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas was recently caught, yet again, butt deep in judicial immorality, taking hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of freebies from a Texas real estate baron who has both a partisan and corporate interest in Thomas's court rulings. So, Cruz to the rescue! No judicial impropriety here, he squawks, for this is nothing but a diabolical plot by Democrats to smear poor Clarence. But Thomas is busy smearing himself, so Dems can just take the advice of Woodrow Wilson. Never attempt to murder a man who's committing suicide. From the start of his court tenure, Thomas has been a shameless seeker of personal gain, tucking untold sums from untold sources in the inner pockets of his judicial robes. He learned to hide his corruption in 2004 when he actually reported taking pricey gifts from a special interest, which got him widely condemned. So, he reformed. No, he didn't quit taking gimmies, he just quit disclosing them. Thomas is a supreme grifter, but sadly he's not alone. Many recent justices have fallen from the pedestal of judicial integrity, cozying up to the moneyed interests. Gifts aside, we now have a hyper-partisan right-wing Republican majority taking their judicial opinions from those same interests, turning America's unelected third branch of government into an autocratic, plutocratic political agency. Then, they wonder why their public approval rating and legitimacy are in the ditch. This is Jim Hightower saying, since they won't reform themselves, we must do it for them. To help, go to fixthecourt.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I find this hard to believe that it looks like we're pretty much split almost down the middle on the debt ceiling fight. In fact, the Washington Post just put out an ABC poll that found 39% of Americans would blame the Republicans in Congress if government goes into default. 36% would blame Biden. 16%, they say they're all bad. Which I kind of get, they're all bad if you're one of them, but I no idea how you go, we're just not going to pay our bills, and that's Biden's fault. Crazy. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day. Maybe get us a different perspective. I've asked my good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst Bob Ney to come share some thoughts. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thank you, Rick.
I know you're in India doing your vacation and that. Is this playing there? I mean, is there any talk of a potential default by the U.S.? Is this something that's in the news there at all?
No, not at all. I mean, I'm still following our news, and I've got a compromise. Let's blame it on Obama. How about that? We'll just go back and blame it on Obama.
No, blame it on Hillary.
The only thing that I hear over here since I've been here, and I talk to people. I ask them, you know, what do you think? And they just, okay. The United States would like to be friendlier with them, and that's how it ends. Of course, they just exceeded China in population, and China, of course, is trying to take over the world currency. So I think if we got a little closer to India, it might help because they now have more people than China. But back to the poll, you know, the Washington Post, ABC News did that poll, as you said, and it's divided. Now you look at, okay, 39% of the people are going to say, it's the Republicans, you know, if they go in default. And then 36 are going to blame Biden. So what does that kind of tell you? Everybody's going to get a jab on this. Pretty equal.
Yeah.
You know? Now, the Republicans may say, well, that's great because, you know, we didn't win the Senate. And, half of them are going to blame Biden, but that doesn't mean that will give them salvation in the next election. Because if this thing goes real, and look, Rick, you've been with the news for how long? I've been with the news for how long? And, you know, the scenario is the same. When we report, they're to the edge, the drama, and, okay, everybody did a continuing resolution. But the issue of default is a lot different even than government shutdown. And right now with the Chinese so overtly trying to make the yuan the currency of the world, this is a gift to them.
Yeah. This is the worst time to do any of this stuff.
Exactly.
And right. This is where I come back to. You ask the average American, should we pay our bills? And they're going to go, absolutely. If you ask a Republican, and this is where I lean on them because I identify as a fiscal conservative. I pay my bills. Ask any fiscal conservative, and they're going to go, you pay your bills. The time to argue over spending was before you pulled your wallet out. That's when we argue over this stuff.
Right, right. And so if I were McCarthy, the Speaker of the House, and I looked at these poll numbers, I don't believe I would say, we're only 3% different than Biden, and we can, you know, do something with this. Let me tell you what will get the Republicans, too. And this is what has happened time after time. When the market, stock market, starts to tumble and the corporate giants start to make the phone calls, that will wake them up.
No, and this is one of those things, and I'm glad you brought that up, because, you know, the sad reality is you know, the mainstream corporate controlled media is pushing out this narrative that the economy's bad. We've been hearing we're on the brink of recession or we're close to recession. You know, it's pretty much the entire Biden presidency. It's almost like they're wishing and hoping and doing everything they can do to make that come to fruition. I mean, you look at what the Fed's doing alone. I'm surprised we're not in deeper trouble than we are. But right. You look at the jobs numbers today. We're still creating jobs. Wages are going up now above inflation, and that's good. It seems like this couldn't happen at a worse time. So if you're pulling this stunt now, it's really not about what it's about, other than it's about making Biden look bad and finally getting us that recession that they so think we deserve.
Well, also on top of it, let's throw out the money reality here. A tight election, whether it's Trump versus Biden or DeSantis or Nikki Haley or whoever, what's a tight election do? Gee, it makes people do what? Raise money, and it makes people do what? Spend money. And what do they spend money on? Television ads. You know, stories. I mean, that's what happens.
No, you're not wrong.
I know that's a plot theory. I understand that. But don't tell me that it's not in the minds of, you know, Rupert and everybody else.
Oh, it is. And look, and thank you, Rupert, for giving us the quote of the century. It's not about red or blue. It's about green, because it's duh. It's what I've been saying all along. It's always about the money.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So here's the thing. I mean, I know you're in the Trump's not going to be the candidate camp, and I know you're going to stay there. And I'm still mm-hmm. going back and forth a little bit. Mm-hmm. Evidently, he's flying back or flew back from Scotland. Going to cut that trip, short. The stated reason was he's going to confront that woman, but he's got a lot of fires burning. There's a lot of stuff going on that he's going to have to get back in the middle of. Any thoughts?
Well, I don't think, as far as the confronting the woman, of course, there was a deposition tape, correct?
Yes.
Now, that was in October of 2022, I think.
Yes.
Right? So that tape's there. It's been played to the jury. He's not required to be there for that. So as far as confronting the woman, he's a former president of the United States. He can be out in the middle of a village in India, you know, and he can say he wants to make a statement and the media is going to pick it up, right?
Exactly.
So what does he have to be physically back for? Why couldn't he have stayed two more days? Something's going on, with the corporation and legal team, something where he was required to be back here.
Yeah. Could it be? I don't know that, you know, the reporting today is more than 8 of the 16 Georgia fake electors have gotten immunity. And you know, I don't know, maybe.
Right.
I don't know, because I think that's real trouble, along with the Fannie Willis, you know, with the perfect phone call and all that. Could it be that? I don't know.
Well, it could. Now, look, I've been reading stories this week, you know, filtering through the news and things like that. And every once in a while, these stories are popping up that DOJ, January 6th, you know, these stories are out there. It's the moment for the attorney general. I don't believe that for a second on the classified documents, because that thing's, you know, a nightmare all the way around. But I see that they've got somebody that was at Mar-a-Lago, and I think the real danger is not DOJ. I really don't. I think it's the, Georgia. And plus anything else that we don't know about that's going to pop up.
Yeah. So let me ask you, because, look, I'm with you. I haven't jumped on any of this. I know when we started off, you know, the left was like, Robert Mueller's coming, and there were memes of, you know, right. Mueller's face in the rearview mirror. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not jumping on any of that. But I think what's going on in Georgia could be kind of a real deal. And I find it interesting that Brian Kemp today signed a law that I guess they're going to figure out a way to, you know, maybe get rid of some of the, how did he put it, get rid of the liberal prosecutors, or, you know, because we're going to make them, you know, follow the law. So I find it interesting that if Fannie Willis does what I think a lot of people are hoping she does, that maybe they come in and remove her, because they've already laid the groundwork, I think, to do that. Or do you see it differently?
No, you look at, now, of course, the whole prosecutor thing, you know, the bill he signed on Friday or today, it makes it, you know, possible, you know, you can oust these district attorneys for office. if they're not adequately enforcing the law. That's how that bill is stated that he signed. Now, that's interesting. You know, adequately enforcing the laws in the eye of the beholder. So definitely they can say, well, this is a malfeasance of the law. You know, she's going after this. That's not enforcing the real law. I mean, when you've got a bill that is that broad that you can remove for not adequately enforcing the law, then you can remove practically anybody. Now, I understand this is on the heels of the whole sources controlling the judicial system thing. I fully understand that, you know. So they can say, well, the timing on this is because of what's going on in other states. We don't want that happening in Georgia. They're letting people run in stores and take all, you know, everything out they want, you know, which in some cases has happened. So I don't think it's that as much as this might be kind of the ace in the hole if the whole situation goes wrong for Trump in Georgia.
Yeah.
It's in the back pocket.
No, we've been talking about this since DeSantis went after that state's attorney, Andrew Warren, I believe. Andrew Warren is his name. We've had him on the show a couple of times. Uh-huh. It's that was like the first opening salvo of this assault to see if he could get away with it. And now they've put this into law. Going to be interesting to see how this plays out, especially given.
Although, if you were Brian Kemp, would you really want to help Trump?
I've got a
you don't want to publicly say you don't. You know,
I got a couple of thoughts on this. You know, part of it is you know, you. I don't know. There's this part of me that goes, this would make him, you know, like if he let Trump off the hook, this would endear him to the MAGA world.
True.
And you know, if he were to pull the plug on this, I'm sure there would be some kind of, you know, deal. Trump's not gonna run again or whatever. Because I said from the beginning, Kemp is a scary figure for me because he's a likable guy. He knows how to. He's a smart guy. Knows how to work the levers. Is well funded. His only problem is he's really only one generation off the plantation of being a plantation owner. And I don't know that we're ready for a former plantation, master. I'm just not sure yet. Mm-hmm. But it'll be interesting to see where this goes.
Well, he could endear himself to Trump. Now, there is one thing. You know, the district attorney, Willis, in Georgia, is going to announce this summer whether she's going to bring charges against Trump and or Trump and his allies, all right? With this whole attempt to overturn the election and how they were attempting to do it in Georgia. Now, what's interesting about this, if let's just do a scenario here. She comes out this summer. She's going to, you know, say that, you know, Trump himself is to be indicted. Georgia moves to remove her because she's, you know, not doing her job, quote. I would sense at that point in time, if this scenario happens, I would bet my car, I like my car, I would bet my car that the Department of Justice would have to step in and scrutinize the whole decision by Georgia and would have the right to step in to scrutinize the decision under this new Georgia law.
Yeah, no, I'm sure there are going to be lawsuits. There's going to be a lot of legal wrangling over this. I'm sure, but it just seems like, you know, they're always a step ahead in moving their agenda. I did want to get your thoughts on something else. Ted Cruz is saying that evidently there's information out there to impeach Joe Biden. Now, he hasn't seen it, but evidently there's enough information. He himself has not seen the document. But he's awareness has been raised, and there's been a lot of talk of on the right of, you know, there's going to be impeachment of Biden, which seems to be their interesting position. But Geraldo Rivera actually had probably the most interesting comment on this whole scenario. He said, "Does anyone really believe President Joe Biden was involved in a criminal bribery scheme?" He said, "Dollars to donuts. It's another bogus, blowhard, pretend whistleblower hint. If the person announcing a would-be criminal scheme is a partisan politician, it's a partisan political event." Any thoughts on this? Because it's kind of bubbling up right now that, you know, there's a whistleblower and they know all this stuff. You put any stock in this?
Well, I think we have to look at the comments too. You know, when you look at Grassley's comments, for example, in the Senate, right? And like anything, when you have criminal cases, and this is really, really important, and if they would ever release, you know, the details on mine, which I've said I'd love to see it. They won't do it, but I'd love to see it. Anytime you have that, you have this flood of people who, you know, when questioned, for example, somebody's questioned about Hunter Biden's taxes, right? And you get somebody that makes a reference of, well, I think this guy knew something. Then all the feds go to that guy. And then that guy says, well, yeah, I heard that, you know, the president himself wrote an email. Okay. This is literally, and in my case, I mean, there's some things I do know where, you know, people said my son's 21st birthday party was paid for by lobbyists, you know, stuff
and
like
that.
Your
son was 8?
Yeah, he was 21, but the best one. This is the best one. And this actually got a reaction out of Los Angeles Times. The Shah of Iran's daughter gave me a boat. I can't make this up. Yes. Now, of course, she had died of a drug overdose in Paris years before, but yeah, she gave me a boat. That actually, and this is the funniest part of it. I had, and my lawyers, I was there when they made the call to justice and said, by the way, you better look because your agent sold him a boat. I had bought a boat. Guess who I bought a boat from? An FBI agent. Okay? And I knew who she happened to be of Iranian-American background. Somehow, that got translated to the Shah of Iran's daughter bought me a boat.
I can see how that goes.
And they investigated. So I make a very – this happened to me. The reason I talk about this is because this is what happens. So somebody has went to Ted Cruz and said, hey, they had this guy that sat down. He saw the president sending the email. And Ted Cruz is taking that, quote, whistleblower, quote, fact, just like the Shah's daughter, and now he's trying to make it a case. It's going to go nowhere. And if they try to do this, this will be the biggest blow-up since Jim Jordan's Federalization Committee, you know?
It's weaponization.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for the smoking gun. But here's the thing, and this is what blows my mind, is what we've done is we've taken talk right-wing talk radio, and, you know, Fox put it on TV, and it, you know, kind of sold. And now we've taken that shock jock kind of shock radio, grievance radio, and we've thrown it in Congress. We've got senators now wanting to be, you know, the Limbaughs of the world. And that's not what they're there to do.
Right, right. And so what they're doing, they want the FBI. This is what Grassley wants the FBI to produce this alleged recording of the whole scheme of Biden. So what we're trying to say here, and this would be remarkable if this actually, you know, were true, but I think Grassley's doing the right thing to say, you know, well, give me, okay, if this tape's out there, okay, where is it? They're trying to say, you know, they've got the president on recording. And that's the rumor mill that's, you know, around the Hill, if you ask anybody. And it's just not going to happen. But Cruz is stating it as, you know, as fact. He should be basically impeached over this. Grassley's been around long enough, you know, Republican in the Senate. He's been around long enough to say, you know, we're starting impeachment. He's been around long enough to not do that.
Yeah. Last question I've got. Evidently some tape. We're back to tapes. Evidently there's some maybe possibly missing tapes from Trump, the Mar-a-Lago years. Or you know, any thoughts on the missing tapes?
Well, I read an article where somebody had packed up something for, I don't know, you know, President Biden, and then Trump's saying that somebody packed up some stuff for him. So you've got, you know, who packed what into the boxes. Now, the tapes, of course, because of the famous missing 15 minutes, doesn't sit well, let's say, for, you know, a Republican. So I basically, I think these aren't they like log tapes?
Yeah. I just said, you know, there's some doctored tapes potentially. And I'm going, you know, quite interesting. You know, we'll see. Here we go again.
Yeah. And I mean, who knows? I don't know that we're ever going to get down to the whole bottom of the classified documents. Probably how this ends is that Congress will step in, let's hope they don't do an investigatory committee. And we waste enough taxpayers' monies on those things. They'll probably step in and say, here's now how you do records, and say, you know, we're going to clean this all up. But as far as the missing tapes and logs, Trump will always be able to say, hey, they weren't my deal. You know, yeah. I didn't do that. He handled it, not me.
No, you're right. And this is where I'm kind of angry and not surprised that we haven't already fixed the system. Look, you go, okay, everyone's got all this classified information. How about we fix it? How about we, you know, do something? There's a body in this country. And I'm trying to remember, they make laws, and you know they fix problems, not create them. They fix them. They're at least there used to be. There used to be a bunch of people that we had be our representatives, and those representatives fixed problems. Maybe we could find out who that is again.
Well, right, and let's look back at one thing here when we talk about the gaps. You know, there was a House committee. I'm trying to remember. This has been well over a year ago. And I don't even know what happened to it. And, you know, I do news. But there was a House committee, and there was, during January the 6th, there were 7 hours, 7 hours of unexplained gaps. Now, how do you have a system in the White House that shuts off by itself? You know?
It was done by they have bad Wi-Fi. That's the reason.
But whatever happened to that whole thing? You know, you don't hear a word now. But what happened to the committee looking into it?
Yeah,
where are the missing hours?
That is a good question, and one we'll have to pick up on. But Bob, as always, I appreciate the time. Great stuff.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you.
Our good friend Bob Ney. Yeah, that's a good question. Where did all that stuff go? Quick break. Right back to wrap things up. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1852. It was the last day of a 3-day convention held in Cincinnati, Ohio. Printers who worked for newspapers and other publications from 14 cities had converged to decide if they wanted to form a union. The printers had first met on the question of starting a union 2 years before in New York City. Now they were ready, and with a vote, the National Typographical Union was born. The very first action of the new union was to denounce Sunday workdays. Only one person cast his vote against the motion. The printers would play a leadership role in the U.S. labor movement. Printers were located in major cities across the U.S. Even more importantly, the union's members often worked for newspapers and had a skill set that could help get the word out about union news and actions. 17 years later, the organization changed its name to the International Typographical Union in recognition of new Canadian locals that joined. That same year, the union decided to let women into its ranks. This made it one of the earliest unions to do so. In 1870, Augusta Lewis was elected as corresponding secretary. She became the first female officer of a nationwide union. The ITU was known to be a very democratic union with strong locals. As printing technology changed, the union faced many challenges. Computers dramatically transformed the work of printing. These technology changes reduced the numbers and strength of the union. In 1986, the ITU merged with the Communication Workers of America. One of the ITU's most famous members was author Mark Twain, who joined the Typographical Union as a young man and proudly held his union card for the rest of his life. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. So I want to wrap today up with, I think, my favorite story of the day. I think the favorite news story that I came across was evidently Fox is upset that Media Matters is using video footage that they obtained from whistleblower, leaker, whatever. And you know, they've now, their lawyers have sent a cease and desist letter saying, we demand you cease and desist from distribution, publication, and misuse of Fox's misappropriated proprietary footage, which you are now on notice was unlawfully obtained. Because look, you know, they've got all of this footage of Tucker Carlson, you know, being crude and offensive and, you know, whatever, making comments that don't make him look professional. There are things that you probably shouldn't have said that, you know, you know he thinks. So, you know, they've been putting this stuff out and Fox is upset about it. Now, what I find interesting, as Angelo Caruson points out, the president of Media Matters, he says that reporting on newsworthy leaked material is the cornerstone of journalism. And he said, for Fox to argue otherwise is absurd and further dispels any pretense that they are a news operation. And I'm telling you, I think they want to get sued by Fox. I think they want to get on that lawsuit so that they can countersue them and maybe make a little bit of money. But anyway, if you missed any of today's program, make sure you grab the podcast. Wherever you find your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. You got questions, comments, thoughts, something I said got under your skin. I want to hear it. Email me, Rick, at the...
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay. WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay. And always streaming on the Civic...